till this century, really, till the 2000, about 2004, I think, when the first book came out from Lee Woodard about these things. And they're really very, very interesting. And as you examine them, what we're doing is examining these manuscripts from a forensic viewpoint. Now, of course, the manuscripts still have to be translated into English, and somebody's doing that. I was reassured that that's the case, although I haven't seen any of the results of that. But some sort of a study comparing them with the other main manuscripts, I think, would be in order. I hope I don't have to do that, although my interest is really piqued by that sort of a question. There are things in there I'd like to know about. But the problem is I don't read Greek, so that makes it a little difficult, as you can imagine. But you have reference books that can help you with something like that, and it's not beyond the possibility that a man who's 76 years old could learn Greek. I don't know if that's possible or not. I do with some difficulty in English, so we have to be careful about that. So here we have these manuscripts, and we're going next week to review everything we've covered over the 3 months. Touch on all of these things in a summary next week. And so if you've missed some parts of it, want to see it again, we'll do that next week. Today we're going to talk about go back to one that we've already covered because of it's a complicated process, but we already talked about the ending on the Gospel of Mark. Well, we're going to go back and revisit that this morning because there's yet some other things in the manuscripts. These manuscripts do not have much in the way of marginal entries, okay? But at the very end of the last manuscript, and remember, they're not in the order that they are in your Bible. It's Matthew, then John, then Luke, and Mark is the final one, okay? Mark is the last manuscript. And at the very end, there's some notations on the page. And so we're going to look at those today because they have a very strong bearing on when these manuscripts were written. Now, what we've tried to emphasize is that the evidence, the forensics evidence, is that these manuscripts were written in the first century. The oldest manuscripts that we had of the complete New Testament date to the 3rd, 4th, 5th centuries. And so they're 100 years, 200, 300 years later. And so the critics looked at that and said, well, you're talking about manuscripts made up from the oral progression of these manuscripts through history, that they were carried by the Christians in their minds and then finally assembled. But that's not the case. If this is a first century manuscript, and we've talked about the fact that there's evidence that the authors of these manuscripts were present at the time they were copied, then we have eyewitness accounts. And that's what the Bible purports for what we call the Gospels, that the good news was recorded for us by eyewitnesses who saw and wrote down what they remembered. And remember this as we talk about it as well, that the memories of these individuals were, you could say, miraculously reinforced, because Jesus said he would call to mind in them when they needed things that he had said. And so in their defense or in their writings, the memories of the eyewitnesses were supernaturally reinforced. The other chore that the writers had was to make what they remembered clear when they wrote it. And that's not an easy task. But God no doubt helped them with that. And we've talked about the fact that occasionally there were things that they had to go back and revisit to clarify a little bit. And so Mark particularly had trouble with his gospel in that regard. And we're going to talk about that this morning to start with, and then we'll talk about what's written on the last page. So just to sort of summarize here, the case. Now, let me also say one other thing. Last week we talked about the fact that the four Gospels were written from four different perspectives that we talked about. That one was written by a close companion of Jesus, and that was John, the beloved disciple. That's what that implies. A second one was written by an apostle, but not of the inner circle, and that would be who? Matthew. Mark writes the third gospel in the series. He's a little further out from the source, but he was alive at the time all of this took place, probably saw Jesus, may have heard his public speeches, and so he wrote from a slightly different perspective, and we talked about the fact that he was probably a priest, and so we're going to go over that again today because it's important to understand some problems with the ending that he had. And the fourth gospel was written by a Gentile, a physician, who was very skilled in the use of the Greek language, and so he writes in the classical Greek, whereas the other three are written in Koine Greek, which was the not really what we would call the street language, but it was the language that was used commonly among people who didn't normally speak Greek as a first language. But Luke did. And so Luke, when he talks about the reality of the birth and the death and the resurrection of Jesus as a Gentile, and he did tremendous research, a couple of years of research, interviewing people so that he could get his gospel just right. That was very impressive to the Gentile world. Okay, so we talked about this in this set of verses and some verses over in Colossians that we'll look at in a minute. But this particular verse tells us a little bit about a man named Barnabas. And you wonder, well, what does Barnabas have to do with it? And we'll get to that in a minute. Now, Joseph, a Levite of Cyprian birth, who was also called Barnabas by the apostles. So Barnabas is not his primary name. His primary name is Joseph, okay? But he's a Levite, okay? What does that mean? He's a Jew, and it means he's part of the priestly tribe, all right? Now, Barnabas, when translated, means what? Son of encouragement. Bar is always in a name, always has reference to the son of so-and-so, the son of somebody. We talked about Jesus' name might be Jesus Bar Joseph, because Joseph was assumed to be his father. This man owned a tract of land, and he sold it, brought the money, and laid it at the apostles' feet. And that's an introduction to the story of Ananias and Sapphira. You might remember that in the book of Acts in the fifth chapter. So he was an impressive person with a good faith, and he contributed to the welfare of the church in its early beginning. But now in Colossians, we learn something else about him. Colossians 4:10. This is the verse that we looked at when we were talking about who is Luke. Luke was a Gentile because Paul goes into some detail about the people that are with him, and he talks about these people as being Jewish, and then he names Luke and others in addition, and obviously then they're Gentiles. So Aristarchus, my fellow prisoner, sends you his greetings. Now, he's one of the Jews. And also Barnabas' cousin Mark. That's kind of interesting. Barnabas wasn't there. Mark was with him, but he talks about him as Barnabas' cousin, about whom you received instructions. If he comes to you, welcome him. He goes on about that. So Barnabas and Mark were cousins. And Barnabas, whose real name was Joseph, is a Levite. Is Mark a Levite? Well, we talked about the evidence that he probably was, other evidence, but this is scriptural evidence that that's the case. If he's a cousin, what does that mean? What are the possibilities? His parents, Mark's parents, and Barnabas's parents were siblings. That's how you generate cousins, isn't it? And so they were either a brother-sister pair or two sisters or two brothers. And the other evidence in the contemporary writers of the time were that these two parents were sisters, that Mark's mother and Barnabas's mother were sisters. And so if Barnabas is a Levite, you can be pretty sure that Mark is too, okay? Now, we talked about early on about the fact that the Codex W was sandwiched in between two wooden plates like this that had painted on them the four individuals who wrote the Gospels. And so that's what this slide is on the screen. Luke and Mark, which were at the back of the books, and so the pictures were turned inward toward the manuscripts. Unfortunately, Matthew and John, who were the first two, were on the outside top of the manuscripts, and so John really got mishandled over the centuries, and so his image is pretty well erased, although you can tell that he had gray hair and a few things about him. The picture about Matthew is in better shape than the one about John. But anyway, we're going to focus on Mark, and we know it's Mark because whoever wrote the pictures, whoever drew the pictures, put his name there. And so you can see I put it in the white area out there, M-A-R-K-O-S, but if you look over in the black border just beside Mark, you see those letters, and that identifies him as Mark. Mark is the only one whose pictures we can tell about. We can't be for sure about John, whose hand is showing, okay? And the others, it's like his left hand here underneath his robe. He's holding his manuscript through the robe. But his right hand is showing, right? It's his right hand that's showing. And there's the middle finger is short on his right hand. And so people wondered about that. One writer in New Testament times said that Mark was known as Stumpy Finger. We remember that. We talked about that. And that he had self-mutilated his hand so that he would no longer be perfect and he would not be conscripted into the service of the priests. And that would only be the case if he were a Levite. So that all fits together. These are all pieces of a puzzle that we're assembling into a big picture, and we'll kind of look at that big picture next week. So there he is with his mutilated right hand. And it is assumed that he did that himself. He just took an axe to it, or a hatchet or a knife or something, and that took a lot of courage to do that. But so he would be free as a Christian. You see, he was converted early in the history of the church, and so he would not be forced, because if they called up your order of priests, you had to go. I mean, you didn't give much of a choice. And that was pointed out by Luke in the story of Zacharias, wasn't it? That his duty came, and he was serving in the temple at the time that he saw the angel who told about the birth of John. So, if you're going to mutilate one of your fingers on one of your hands, do you hit the finger on your dominant hand or your less dominant hand? If you're right-handed, you would hit the finger on your left hand, and if you're left-handed, you would mutilate your right hand. I think I would. Does that make sense to everybody? Well, you wouldn't want to do that to the hand that you normally use for everything. Now, that's important. It's coming up in a minute, so kind of keep that in mind. His right hand was mutilated, so he was probably left-handed. This is the way you put together mysteries and things like that. You hear mystery stories and so on and see things on TV. And so that's how a mystery is concocted. And so we're looking at circumstantial evidence that makes a piece of the puzzle, and we put all of this together ultimately into a bigger picture. All of this You could argue that it was some sort of accident that he got tangled up in a power saw or something, but that's not likely in the first century. Okay. All right. So here is Mark, the 16th chapter. He has written this probably in Aramaic, and so the scribe is translating it into Greek and writing it out. And we went over this. And when you get down to verse 8, where it says, up to this point, the women had discovered that Jesus had been resurrected. And you can read that story in your Bible. And they went back to tell the apostles, but the apostles didn't believe them. But before he gets to that point in the story, go tell his disciples, this is the angel speaking to him, and Peter, that he is going before you to Galilee. There you will see him, as he told you. And they went out and fled from the tomb, for trembling and astonishment had come upon them. And they said nothing to anyone, for they were afraid. And we talked about the fact that this ending, that's just where it ends. This ending occurs in two of the major manuscripts, Sinaiticus and Vaticanus, and it ends with this word, G-A-R. And I am going back and listening to the transcripts of the lesson that I taught you before about this. I misspoke about that. The word for they were afraid is this word, phobos, F-O-B-O-U. And so the word G-A-R is an intensifier like our word very, okay? They were very afraid. I wanted to correct that because I told you wrong. All right. So that's where it ends. And it's a strange place for it to end. Why did it end that way? Why did Mark end his writing of his gospel where he did in chapter 16, verse 8? And the clue is, I think, that he was trained as a Jewish priest, and something about that interfered with his writing at this point. You know what it was? He was a Sadducee. If you look in your Bible dictionary about the Pharisees and the Sadducees, you remember those terms? The Sadducees were the priestly group. Almost all of the Sadducees were priests, and most of the priests were Sadducees. I mean, that was a pretty tight-knit community. And the Sadducees had some rather strange beliefs. And it's mentioned several times in the Bible. Each of the gospel writers comment on this. Matthew 22:23 says, on that day, some Sadducees who say there is no resurrection came to Jesus and questioned him. You remember what they asked him? The story about the lady who married somebody and he died. She married a brother and he died. She married another brother and he died. Married a fourth brother, he died. By that time, I would have thought the brothers would have gotten the trend. But anyway, in their story, that always tickles me. In the story, though, she goes through seven brothers and the last one dies. And then their question is, whose wife is she in the resurrection? They didn't believe in the resurrection, see? And if we go over into the 23rd chapter of Acts, I think it is, Paul used the fact that the Sadducees didn't believe in the resurrection, but the Pharisees did. He used that to start an argument between them when they were trying to attack him before a judge. And so that always got their goat. You would think that some parts of the Old Testament would have given them trouble if they didn't believe in the resurrection. What comes to mind? Elijah? And so we have Elijah carried to heaven. We also have We also have the things that Daniel wrote about the resurrection in his closing chapter. We've got the stories of Ezekiel, the dry bones that came back to life. All of that must have been a puzzle to them. But nonetheless, they didn't believe in the resurrection, and they didn't believe in some other things. Do you remember what else is included? That's in that list in Acts 23. They didn't believe in the Spirit. They didn't believe in angels. They didn't believe in the resurrection. And so that had been his training. And so he wrote through, Mark wrote through all of his gospel. He did conquer his understanding about angels because he talks about them. Although he doesn't introduce Jesus' parents like Matthew and Luke do, angels coming to Joseph, the angel Gabriel coming to Mary. He doesn't talk about that. He starts his gospel with John the Baptist preaching. But anyway, here he comes to the end of his gospel, and he's faced with this describing the resurrection. And he's got some problems. I think that's why he stopped where he stopped. Okay, he had some questions. Who can he ask? Well, he can ask Luke. Luke's done some research in it. He can ask Matthew, and he asked John and others who are Christians. But his problem isn't that I don't believe in the resurrection. It's just a strange subject to him. How am I going to describe that? And so I think that's why he stopped at verse 8. He had to go back and get some more information before he completed it. But unfortunately, some copies were made that also stopped at verse 8. So I think the fact that he was a priest is part of the explanation of why this ended like it did at verse 8 in the last chapter of Mark. So, and that ended down in the middle of the page, on the front side of the page. Remember, there's a front and a back side of each page in the choirs that go through the book. And so the back side of that page was blank. And something got written at the top of the back side. And it's kind of hard to see under low magnification, but right up here, there's some letters. See them along the top? Actually, the edge of the page was probably back as far as the white goes on the screen here. And it's all decayed away and shrunk down and including that a little bit of that writing. Something written there rather clumsily in large Greek letters. Let's look at that. That's where it is, where the arrow is, if everybody couldn't see my laser beam. Okay, so we're going to enlarge that. And that's on one side of your handout. Okay? So here's what is written up there. And some of these letters are clear enough. That's an L. And particularly over here, N-A-O is a little O, and another N here. And so I have written that in for you here and emphasized it. And then S-O-U, which is over here, S-O-Y. It looks like a Y, but it's a U. And then you've got another word over here, L-O-Y-E, which is written out there. And something in the middle which is faded, and we can't tell what's there. Probably was a word there as well. As well as maybe something back here. There's what looks like a diagonal there, but there's not enough of it to tell what letter it was. But the words that we have there are interesting, especially because what that says is cleanse your naon is the temple. That's what that always means in Jerusalem. Cleanse your temple. Why would the priest, Mark, be concerned about cleansing the temple? This has to be in the mid-60s AD. when Jerusalem was under siege and the zealots were piling bodies in the courts of the temple, they didn't have a place to bury them. And the whole temple had been desecrated, but not yet destroyed. When was it destroyed? A.D. 70. When the Romans finally entered the city and set everything on fire and destroyed the temple. The destruction of the temple had been predicted, of course, by Jesus. And so he had told his apostles this was going to happen. And had warned everybody to get out of the city when the armies were approaching. So, this writing at the top has to be early. That is one of the very strongest evidences that this particular book, the Codex W, is a first century book. Now, the letters are kind of awkward. It's obvious they're much bigger than the letters in the manuscript itself. And what looks like a Y to us, which is really a capital U, curves back to the right. The Y's in the manuscript itself always tail off to the left. And Lee Woodard looked at that and said, the guy who wrote that at the top was left-handed. Do you know how the slopes of the letters change? So that's circumstantial evidence. We don't have any idea. He didn't sign it, but it suggests an individual who was not very familiar with the Greek letters, which would have fit Mark very well, and he was writing left-handed, and he was rather awkward in his spacing and construction of the letters. So that, Lee Woodard and I both agree, that's very strong evidence that was put on this manuscript before the temple was destroyed. All right. There's what I just said. The writing is awkward, badly spaced. Slope of the tails of the letter Y trails to the right, suggesting that the writer's left-handed. It may have been Mark. Okay. Now, that's not all. Down at the bottom, after the signing of the material, remember there are, and we'll talk about this next week some more, there are these seals appended at the bottom, and then it always has at the end the gospel according to Mark, and then there's something else added down here. Now, at the time that this was written at the top, this had not been put in, probably, and it was a blank space on the back side of the page. But by the time this was written, of course, all of this had been put in, as well as this closing figure. It probably tells us something about the time as well. And then there's this business at the bottom. It's smeared over here and somewhat decayed, and so it's difficult to know exactly what it says, but much of it is quite clear. Notice that the letters are about the same size as these. These are smaller than the letters at the top. And this is script Greek, whereas this is a scribe's printing of the Greek. So the script Greek is a little different, but we can make out some things about that. So here we have a Christe, which is one form of the word Christ. So it's kind of a blessing. The next word here is an A-G-I, which means holy. And then there's some words in here that are not clear to me, but apparently they mean upon or on. In other words, Christ, Holy Spirit, on the servant, on your servant. Here's the S-O-U that means your. And then something over here. I suspect that what's written in the blur over here is Mark. And someone else came along later on, probably the same scribe. The letters are similar, but the ink is a little different. And the entire family of him is what this says. And then there are these crosses here, here, and here. You see those? What does all that mean? Barnabas is Mark's cousin, okay? And I think this is a blessing on Mark from his brother, from his cousin, Barnabas. Now, if you look carefully, there's some tiny writing, particularly visible in this cross. These are too dark to see that. But here's one, the way it appears on the paper. There's a large letter here. And this shape right here is the Greek letter rho. And it looks to be a stylized signature of B-A-R-N-A-B-A-S. The S at the end, which is normally like our capital letter C, has a tail on it, but there may be some decorations or something down here. We don't know. But it looks like the word, and others, Lee Woodard, and even the early scholar who looked at that and said, that seems to be Barnabas. Now, it could be any Barnabas. Barnabas is probably a common name. But the fact that it's Mark's cousin suggests that the scribe who did all of this, and incidentally, all of Codex W except the first 16 pages of the Gospel of John. Remember, that one had been carried over from a previous manuscript. That's a choir of pages. Those first, there are eight leaves, four folded pages. Those pages were done by a different scribe, but all the rest of it, with the possible exception of the first page of Matthew, which was a legal document carried in, it's the genealogy. The rest of it was done by one scribe, and the suggestion here is that scribe was Barnabas. You can see if he was kind of proud of this, he kind of made himself a calling card here. He would draw a line, write his name on it, then draw a line around it, and with this large row that carried through it. Now, there may be some letters in the row, four letters here, which Lee Woodard thinks are Aramaic letters representing the name Mark, but I can't vouch for that. Okay. Here are the other two. And there's probably some letters in there too, but they're hard to see and they're not quite in focus. So the conclusions. And the conclusions are circumstantial. They always are. When you're looking at evidence where you don't have things documented and certified and everything, you have to make some guesses. And so we're looking at some assumptions here, some pieces of the puzzle that fit together with the rest of the story, but we can't be sure of this. But the pleading prayer at the top of the last page asking for cleansing of the temple. Incidentally, who can do that? Only God and Jesus can do that. It's clearly a prayer. Was likely entered by Mark in the late 60s A.D. When Jerusalem was under siege. And the word had gotten back that the temple had been desecrated. And, of course, if you're a priest, that was terrible news. And so he quickly scribbled something on the backside of the last page of the codex at the top of the page. And, of course, it's decayed away a little bit so that it's right at the edges. When Jerusalem was under siege and the zealots were dumping dead bodies in the temple courts, at that time, the last page was blank. The blessing conferred on Mark at the end of his gospel was probably written by the scribe in A.D. 72. That's the date from the diagram at the end, which we think indicates the date in which the scribe finished his work. And for Mark, that was A.D. 72. For Matthew, it was A.D. 60, 67, if I recall right, and for Luke it was AD 73. So those men were all in Egypt, close to what we call Cairo, at AUN or ON in Egypt, in the mid-60s, early 70s. And apparently Barnabas came back later on to do John's manuscript as well, when both of them would have been old men. The stylized signature of the scribe, three crosses surrounding the blessing, contains Greek lettering that can be interpreted as Barnabas, Mark's, and of course, it can be guessed that it was Mark's cousin. Well, that suggests that this manuscript was very, very critical to the development of the early church. They wanted to get everything in writing. They wanted to get it all done in a form that could be copied, that could be distributed elsewhere, and they made it in the form of Codex W, which they kept at On, and eventually buried in the sands there during the persecution of Rome and at the end of the 200s. So it was probably there for over 100 years, and then ultimately wrapped up and buried in the sand to be uncovered again in 1906. So there, buried close to 2,000 years, wasn't it? And survived. That's the amazing thing. So the fewer people who were involved in it, and the more close-knit they were, the apostles, Luke and Mark and Barnabas, that knew about all of this and that were making these copies to be distributed around the world at a time. First, we had in the 60s, we had Nero's persecution. In the 90s, you had Domitian. Yeah, the Domitian persecution and other persecutions. It was not easy being a Christian for the first few hundred years until Rome made it all legal in the 300s. So it was done in secret. The fewer people who knew, the better, and the more close-knit they were and that trusted each other. So you can picture a small group of men who were all faithful Christians who were working together to get this manuscript made and then copied. And so it was a full-time job. They didn't have printing presses, so they had to do it all by hand. I'll remind you that the pictures that we have shown of the manuscripts themselves are online and available from this Center for the Study of New Testament Manuscripts. That's in Plano, Texas. I think I may go up there on one of my trips to North Texas and go visit that place. And the initial research was done by Dr. Lee Woodard in the aughts of our century, beginning around 2000 and running through 2008 when he published his second book. And he's still there. I'm thinking that we ought to put together this story in some sort of book form or publish in some kind of a journal, so we'll see what happens to that in the future. But I think it's important that we get a feel for the reality of the Gospels, the fact that they are eyewitness accounts, that they were done carefully, that they were transcribed seriously. And it isn't an oral tradition ultimately written down. It's documentation by the people who lived with Jesus. All right, now we still have about 5 minutes, so here's a hand. Oh, yeah, they will argue it, sure. Yeah, you'll meet people who would deny any kind of evidence because they don't want to believe it. But it's important for us who do want to believe it and do understand it that it is reasonable material here. And there's some aspects of this that we will point out next week in our summary that are difficult to argue with. Now, some parts of it, whether or not this Barnabas was the cousin of Mark, we don't know, but that's a logical possibility. There are a bunch of pieces to the puzzle that are... when you work a jigsaw puzzle, you may have a whole bunch of pieces that seem to fit and the colors are about right, and so you try to drop them in. Maybe you can find some reason why they don't fit just exactly right. And so this is just the beginning of a story that will be researched, I hope, in detail as people begin to take this manuscript seriously and it undergoes a much more rigorous examination. No C14 dating of anything so far to find out if the vellum is really as old as it ought to be. And there's always the possibility that somebody deliberately tried to deceive us. Keep that in mind. That's one of the arguments that are made about these things. If you follow a journal like Biblical Archaeology Review, you'll find all kinds of arguments in there about whether this or that lamp or item that has been dug out of the sand in Egypt or somewhere else, whether or not that's real. In Israel particularly, they dig up things and they say, well, this is something out of Solomon's temple. And then someone else says, well, it can't be because, and so they discuss this at length. Well, and it's possible because people who in this day and age, in Jerusalem, who had a page of a document like this that had writing on it, they could, and there are people who do this, that they would forge it and try to make it look like it's biblical, when it really isn't. But to do this for a document that's 370-something pages long, to do that would have been a real challenge to any forger in modern times. It's not a simple thing to do. The script at the top of the last page could have been added by the guy who dug it up. You can't argue with that except for the fact that it's right in the decay part of the edge of the page, and it would probably have torn the page up to try to write on it. So you see, you got arguments and counter-arguments about this, and my tendency is to believe that this is all on the up and up. There's just so many things about it that look that way. Okay. Tyrone? Sure. Yeah. Fulfilled prophecy. Yeah, we looked at that verse in the beginning, didn't we? Okay. I had heard that it had been, that they were going to do it, but it has to be done by the Smithsonian. The Smithsonian likes to support biblical research when it isn't challenging anything that they're particularly interested in, but if it challenges evolution and modern science in some way, then they drag their feet on it. And so I don't really know if it's been done or going to be done, and I certainly don't know the results. Now, the carbon-14 dating of the vellum would only give us a date plus or minus 75 years or something like that. It's not all that precise because the paper may be contaminated by modern bacteria that throw things off. So that's always a problem. That's right. No, the ink, they can tell about the ink because historically ink was made several different ways. And to get it black and to make it permanent, they had to use a certain formula. Well, that formula changed through the ages, and so by looking at the content, which you can do with an analytical instrument and decide how much iron it contains, how much zinc, how much other things, they can pretty well tell which century it was, but whether or not the ink has even been examined here, I don't think it has. And certainly the only scholar who looked at it so far from a major institution was this doctor from the University of Michigan, Henry Sanders, who did his work in 1910. So he didn't have he didn't have access to all of the modern technologies. All he had to look at was the shapes of the letters and compare it with other manuscripts, which is what he did. But you can only get so much that way. All right, so we're going to stop with our examination of material, and next week we're going to try to put together a review that shows you the key elements in sequence. You can see why we didn't try to do it all at once. There's just too much here. But remember, we're talking forensic evidence, which is kind of interesting. If you could do fingerprints, we don't know what Mark's fingerprints looked like, but anyway.